KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
If they're not back by the time I get into office, all hell will break out in the Middle East.
President-elect Donald Trump held a wide-ranging news conference in Palm Beach, Florida. We hear from our correspondent who was in the room.
For Tuesday, January 7th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The social networking company Meta will stop using third-party fact-checkers on its platforms.
The company, which owns Facebook and Instagram, will instead rely on users to add notes to posts.
What's happening here is really very political, a response to a change in the political winds and their own concerns about what might happen to them.
And the U.S. recorded its first human bird flu death in Louisiana.
We are, I think, fooling ourselves that we have enough vaccine capacity and the ability to respond quickly.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Naval Academy Glee Club in the Capitol Rotunda, as family, members of Congress, and Supreme Court justices paid tribute to the nation's 39th president, Jimmy Carter. Escorted by the military, Carter's body was taken by horse-drawn caisson to the steps of the Capitol, then into the rotunda, where he will lie in state. Vice President Kamala Harris praised Carter for his good works and ethics while in office and for his fundamental decency and humility.
James Earl Carter, Jr., loved our country. He lived his faith. He served the people. And he left the world better than he found it.
After eulogizing Carter today, Senate Majority Leader John Thune and House Speaker Mike Johnson, Carter's body will return to Georgia after a state funeral at Washington National Cathedral Thursday. President Carter died last month at the age of 100. Judge Aileen Cannon is temporarily blocking the Justice Department from releasing a final report by Special Counsel Jack Smith in his two cases against President-elect Donald Trump. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports defense lawyers had asked the Florida judge to weigh in.
Judge Cannon, who was appointed to the bench by Trump, ordered the DOJ not to share Jack Smith's final report until a federal appeals court resolves the legal fight. Smith had been set to transmit his report to Attorney General Merrick Garland with an eye toward releasing it to the public as soon as this week. But Trump argues the special counsel was appointed unlawfully and that any public report would be legally invalid and hurt his transition into the White House. Federal prosecutors dropped two criminal cases against Trump after he won the 2024 election, and the final report by Smith may be the last chance for prosecutors to explain their decisions. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Last week's deadly truck attack in New Orleans will get a full review from Louisiana's Attorney General Matt Bloom with member station WWNO as more.
Attorney General Liz Merle says her review of last week's attack will look at, quote, patterns and conduct within the New Orleans Police Department and City Hall. Merle says security changes are needed.
I would expect that to happen, because we can't ignore what happened and pretend like it didn't happen or that it was just a one-off event.
City leaders have faced criticism for the lack of protective barriers around Bourbon Street on New Year's Eve. Temporary barriers have since been installed. And this week, President Biden granted a request from city officials to provide additional federal resources for Mardi Gras season security. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in New Orleans.
Stocks lost ground on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 178 points. The Nasdaq fell 375 points. The S&P 500 was down 66 points. This is NPR. Authorities in South Florida say the bodies of two people were found in the landing gear compartment of a JetBlue plane. The airline saying the bodies were found during a post-flight inspection last night at the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport. Names of the individuals were not immediately released. The plane arrived in Fort Lauderdale after flying from JFK Airport in New York. Folk singer Peter Yarrow has died at the age of 86. He was best known as a member of the trio Peter, Paul, and Mary. Jeff London has this look back at Yarrow's career.
The son of Ukrainian Jewish immigrants, Peter Yarrow, grew up in New York City and began performing folk music at Cornell. He met Mary Travers and Paul Stuckey in the Greenwich Village folk scene, and the three teamed up as Peter, Paul, and Mary. The trio was an enormous success in the early 1960s, and Yarrow co-wrote this top 40 hit.
Pop the magic drive.
Yarrow was a political activist throughout his life, but his reputation was tarnished because of a sexual assault conviction against a minor in 1970. He served 3 months in prison and was ultimately pardoned by President Jimmy Carter. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
It's pretty pricey to bring samples back from Mars, but NASA is pitching some more cost-efficient options. NASA Administrator Bill Nelson pulling the plug on an original plan after costs soared to $11 billion, and instead asking industry and others to try to come up with better options to get Martian rock samples back to Earth ahead of astronauts possibly venturing to the red planet. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives, and the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Firefighters are battling a growing blaze in Los Angeles County. The Palisades fire is driven by unusually strong winds and fueled by extremely dry conditions. More than 30,000 people are under mandatory evacuation orders, and at a press conference Tuesday afternoon, Los Angeles Councilmember Tracy Park urged residents to heed those orders.
Obviously, the scope and scale of today's fire here in the Palisades has been terrifying. We are so incredibly grateful for the swift response.
Here with more is LAist reporter Jacob Margolis. Jacob, thanks for joining us, and just bring us up to speed. What is the situation?
The fire's grown to more than 1,200 acres. It started about 10:30 this morning, and it really has blasted through the area. But it's not the size of the fire that has caught our, it's so concerning. It's primarily that it's entered into highly developed areas. So it's gone from this kind of part in the mountains here in Southern California around LA that run right up against the ocean. It's gone from the mountains, this kind of wild spot, down into these developed communities. We're seeing people have to evacuate on foot. They've abandoned their cars because they couldn't, I guess, get out fast enough. The flames were too close. And it's quite concerning because we're now also seeing bulldozers have to push those cars out of the way so firefighters could get up to actually work on the fire. We do know that some structures have caught on fire, but we won't know how many have been destroyed or damaged for some time. But to give some, idea of scope, 30,000 people are under evacuation orders. More than 13,000 structures are threatened. And miraculously, no injuries have yet been reported. And I just saw a video from along the coast that shows that the fire has indeed reached the ocean.
I was just watching video too, and you can see how the wind is driving this. These extremely strong winds you're getting. How big a factor is that?
Huge. Wind-driven fires are a major thing here, especially in Southern California. And the fact that we haven't had any rain, for any substantial rain, for 260-plus days here, it usually would come by November or December, means we're still quite dry. And so any spark that kicks off is, one, going to catch the vegetation on fire, and two, that wind can throw those embers a mile plus ahead of the fire front, making actually containing the fire and drawing a solid fire line at times all but impossible. And by the way, the topography of this area, if you haven't been to Los Angeles, the mountains are quite steep. It is really hard for firefighters to get in there and hike up a lot of those hills. It's very difficult for them to establish those lines. And also, flames go crazy through a lot of those drainages. And again, can be quite dangerous, especially when it runs into neighborhoods like the ones that it has today.
So it sounds like it's just so dry. How unusual is that for this time of year? And do we know if climate change is playing a role?
Yeah, Santa Ana winds, which these are very strong easterly winds, are completely normal this time of year. California does have variable weather. The place where we definitely see climate change impacts is increased heat, which does, of course, dry out vegetation and makes the land even thirstier than it normally would be.
And just quickly, overnight, what are conditions looking like?
Winds are going to worsen through the morning, and I'm hoping we don't wake up to entire neighborhoods destroyed.
Jacob Margolis from LAist, thank you. Stay safe.
Yes.
President-elect Donald Trump held a news conference today at his home in Palm Beach, Florida. The purpose was to announce a new investment in American infrastructure from a Dubai developer. But for more than an hour, he covered a wide range of topics, including the hostages still held by Hamas in Gaza and the anniversary of the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez was in the room for that press conference, and he joins us now. Hi, Franco.
Hey, Juana.
So, Franco, tell us what today's event was like. What was this announcement?
Well, I mean, you got to the crux of it. It was about a new foreign investment. A Dubai developer is promising to invest at least $20 billion in the U.S. The plan is to build data centers across the Midwest and the Sun Belt. But after talking about the investment and the jobs it would create, Trump quickly moved to basically a laundry list of complaints. And they largely seem to have been triggered by President Biden's announcement yesterday to protect 625 million acres of ocean from offshore oil and gas drilling in most U.S. coastal waters. Trump was clearly angry, and he promised to reverse the ban on day one of his administration and take it to the courts if needed. And I'll just note that this is something that may be hard to do on his own. It could require Congress to do. He also launched into a more circuitous list of complaints, including vote counting delays, the Justice Department, or as he said, the Injustice Department, Biden's chaotic withdrawal of Afghanistan, and he also complained about Biden's clean energy policies, including the promotion of electric vehicles, electric heaters over gas-powered heaters, and the prevalence of windmills, which he plans to prohibit in the future.
Franco, we mentioned earlier that he spoke about those hostages still held by Hamas in Gaza. What did he have to say about them?
Yeah, I mean, he warned again that Hamas will pay a high price if the hostages are not released before his inauguration.
If they're not back by the time I get into office, all hell will break out in the Middle East.
Can you elaborate?
And it will not be good for Hamas, and it will not be good, frankly, for anyone. All hell will break out.
He said this several times while also declining to elaborate on what he means exactly. I mean, he also brought up his new envoy for the Middle East region, Steve Witkoff, who has been traveling to the area and collaborating with the Biden administration on these issues. Interestingly, Witkoff actually praised the Biden administration for including him and the Trump team in all the discussions. And he said everyone was on the same page here about getting hostages home before the inauguration. But he really credited Trump with ramping up the pressure to get the talks to the place that they are at right now.
Okay, got it. I know he covered a lot, Franco. What other national security issues did he talk about?
Well, Greenland and Panama were probably the bigger ones. You know, he would not rule out using military force to acquire Greenland or the Panama Canal. He called them both a necessity for national and economic security. And he said the U.S. adversaries are just too close in Greenland and too close to U.S. assets.
You don't even need binoculars. You look outside, you have China ships all over the place. You have Russian ships all over the place. We're not letting that happen. We're not letting it happen.
He also questioned whether Denmark has a legal right to the territory and threatened massive tariffs if Denmark resists U.S. efforts.
Franco, you were there. You were in the room. I'm curious, did you get to ask President-elect Trump a question? And if you did, what was it?
Yeah, I asked about the meeting or a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin about talking about the ending the war in Ukraine, and he would not commit to a date, but he said it would be early in his administration, likely within 6 months, and he emphasized it needed to be soon, considering the devastation being caused and the lives lost.
That's NPR's Franco Ordonez in West Palm Beach, Florida. Thank you.
Thank you, Juana.
Remember Thailand's viral baby pygmy hippo, Mudeng? She was born this past summer. Her slick body and photogenic face made the miniature moist mammals a fan favorite. Now, America has its own baby pygmy hippo, born in Virginia just before Christmas, and she is already going viral in her own right. Brad Kuttner with Radio IQ went to see this cute little baby in person.
I walk into the pygmy hippo pen at the Metro Richmond Zoo just as the newborn baby follows her mother Iris out of a hatch and slides into a fresh pool of water. That grunting is the baby's father, Corwin, in a nearby pen. Meanwhile, in the water, the little one quickly latches on to mama.
They will rest their heads on mom so that mom can support them while they're still in the water.
That zookeeper, Rachel Grimm. As we talk, the baby's moon-eyed head bobs in the water like a brown and pink ice cube, kicking her tiny legs, wiggling her little ears, splashing water as she tries to nurse.
They are very nurturing to their young.
That's zoo director Jim Andelin.
In fact, Iris does not want to leave that baby, and they go into a bedroom at night, and the baby walks almost underneath her, a little bit in front. It's a pretty precocious little girl, and so she'll sometimes lead the way, but there's never more than a couple feet distance from them.
Pygmy hippos are native to West African forests and swamps and are a lot smaller than their Nile hippo counterparts. They're famous for their sheen.
The body, if you rubbed your hand on it, it's just slimy.
They secrete oils that help keep them from getting sunburn in the wild, and so that secretion is pretty slick.
With only a few thousand remaining in their native habitat, they're also endangered. The Metro Richmond Zoo has been part of a program hoping to increase their numbers since they first got Corwin in 2018. There's a database that matches pairs based on genetics. This is the third pygmy hippo born at the Metro Richmond Zoo. The new hippo is already helping the private zoo attract visitors like Dixie Kilduff and her daughter Courtney, who drove over an hour and a half to get here.
We're serious fans.
Yes. I just think they're really cute animals, and I really wanted to see her as she was born.
To drum up notoriety, the zoo held an online poll to pick a name for the new pygmy hippo. Over 100,000 people weighed in from 165 countries. The winner announced today was Poppy, a flower like her mother Iris. Hammy May, in honor of Virginia Hams, came in second. Courtney Kilduff was Team Hammy May.
I like the tie to Virginia, and I think it's unique. I like that Poppy is related to her mom, but I just think that Hammy May has a nicer southern ring to it.
In a statement, zoo officials had a message for Hammy May fans. We see you. We feel your pain. We hope we can all come together and move forward as a nation. For NPR News, I'm Brad Kuttner in Chesterfield County, Virginia.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Meta, the company that owns Facebook and Instagram, is getting rid of fact checks. The fact check program was created to help limit the spread of falsehoods on its platforms, but it's become a target of conservative claims of censorship. In a video announcing the changes, CEO Mark Zuckerberg echoed those claims.
We've reached a point where it's just too many mistakes and too much censorship.
NPR's Shannon Bond joins us now to talk this through. Hey, Shannon.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay, how did Meta explain this decision today?
Yeah, I mean, this fact-checking program had been in place since 2017, and it was originally a response to the 2016 election when Russia used Facebook and other platforms to spread false claims to try to influence American voters. And this was really an approach that Mark Zuckerberg had championed. You know, Meta set an industry standard in the way for dealing with false and misleading posts. But now Zuckerberg says his views have shifted, as we heard. He thinks the company has gone too far, and he had particularly harsh words for these fact-checking organizations the company has long partnered with, which are largely nonprofit journalism groups.
But the fact-checkers have just been too politically biased and have destroyed more trust than they've created, especially in the U.S.
And we can hear he's very much adopting the framing that President-elect Trump and Republicans have been using for a long time in making attacks on content moderation, even though we know that research shows that online conservative content, you know, is quite popular. Many of the fact checkers I spoke with object to Zuckerberg's framing. They say their work adds context to posts, but ultimately they don't have any power over what Meta decides to do about, you know, keeping up or taking down posts.
So how is this going to work? Will anybody be able to write whatever they want, or is something going to replace the fact checks?
Facebook and Instagram are going to shift to a user-generated community notes program. That might sound familiar. It's the approach that Elon Musk has taken at X. But of course, you know, notes written by users that appear on posts are very different than professional fact-checking that is, you know, researching the veracity of claims.
Sure.
Now, Mary Louise, this is all part of bigger changes that Zuckerberg is rolling out to deal with that problem we heard him speak about, this problem of over-enforcement and mistakes. So basically, Meta is going to largely pull back on labeling or taking down posts, on handing out suspensions or other penalties outside of areas, you know, it referred to as, quote, illegal and high severity violations, things like terrorism, child sexual exploitation. And it's also notable that Meta is moving its internal content moderation team from California to Texas. And Zuckerberg described that as another way to combat this perception of liberal bias.
Let me raise the timing of this. We're, of course, less than 2 weeks away from President-elect Trump's inauguration. Is that a coincidence?
Well, I spoke with Bill Adair, who's the founder of PolitiFact, which was one of the first fact checkers Meta worked with. I asked him that.
What's happening here is really very political, a response to a change in the political winds and their own concerns about what might happen to them.
Now, you know, Meta has, of course, had a rocky relationship with Trump for a long time. The company suspended Trump from Facebook and Instagram for 2 years following the Capitol riot on January 6, 2021. And recently, during the 2024 election, Trump accused Zuckerberg personally of election interference. He even threatened him with jail time if Trump returned to office. And so, you know, in that context, this move looks like yet another part of Meta's efforts to smooth things over. It's named Dana White, CEO of the Ultimate Fighting Championship, and a close ally of Trump to its board this week. It's elevated a longtime Republican executive, Joel Kaplan, as head of global affairs. It's donated a large sum to Trump's inauguration, and Zuckerberg has visited Trump at Mar-a-Lago. And so it seems like Meta and other tech companies are working very hard to make sure they are on the right side of an incoming administration that has been attacking this industry.
That is NPR's Shannon Bond reporting on the news that Meta, the company that owns Facebook and Instagram, they are getting rid of fact checks. Thanks, Shannon.
Thanks so much.
Concerns around bird flu have intensified in recent months, and just yesterday, the U.S. recorded its first bird flu death in Louisiana. Soon, the Trump administration will have to steer the federal response to the outbreak. NPR's Will Stone reports on the challenges it will face.
At this point, there's no way to predict if this strain of bird flu will spark a full-blown pandemic. As the virus infects more mammals, more humans, it has more opportunities to mutate in ways that could spell trouble.
This is like brush burning around your house that you better pay attention to, because it could turn into something else.
That's Dr. Jesse Goodman. He helped lead the Food and Drug Administration's response to swine flu in 2009. He's now at Georgetown.
And I would say this is one of the things we don't do as a society very well. We tend to deal with either four-alarm fire or complete denial.
The Biden administration recently ramped up its work on bird flu, putting more than $300 million into pandemic preparation, expanding testing in the dairy industry. But this comes after months of criticism. Goodman says the response has been sluggish in some ways. Dr. Andrew Pavia at the University of Utah agrees. He's been involved in influenza pandemic preparedness for more than two decades.
The response has been slow and has lacked a sense of urgency that I think it should have.
There are gaps in testing and surveillance. The outbreak in dairy cattle is not contained.
In my mind, the biggest elephant in the room is our ability to produce vaccine. We are, I think, fooling ourselves that we have enough vaccine capacity and the ability to respond quickly.
The federal government is increasing its stockpile, and newer vaccines, including some using mRNA technology deployed against COVID, are being developed. But Pavia worries about what could happen in the new administration.
We're all very concerned about the decrease in trust in vaccines. Having RFK Jr. on the political stage only makes that worse.
The Trump transition team did not respond to NPR's request for comment on its plans to tackle bird flu. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the administration's pick to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, has a long track record of making inaccurate and misleading claims about the safety of vaccines, as does the advocacy group he founded. He's already made statements in an online post undermining the bird flu vaccines.
If this thing becomes a pandemic, people are going to demand vaccines.
Jennifer Nuzzo is an epidemiologist at Brown University.
What I am worried about is whether any ideologic oppositions or perhaps lack of understanding of science gets in the way of a swift response that prevents as many deaths as possible.
But Dr. Carlos Del Rio, an infectious disease expert at Emory University, says he's not going to speculate. He points out a lot of public health happens on the local level, and Trump does already have a vaccine track record.
The Trump administration developed a COVID vaccine, right? So they have experience with Operation Warp Speed that was pretty unique.
Dr. Luciana Borio, now at the Council on Foreign Relations, was acting chief scientist at the FDA from 2015 to 2017. She says the incoming administration should double down on treatments and vaccines right away.
And I think that historically, at least, you know, pandemic preparedness has been a bipartisan effort. And no president and no Congress wants to see people dying of an influenza pandemic needlessly.
Jesse Goodman, who was also once at the FDA, says the Trump administration needs to support the federal workforce responsible for pandemic preparation.
You want to keep the best people, not scare them away.
Because he says they will be critical for making sure the country is safe. Will Stone, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Years ago, Jimmy Carter drew ferocious criticism.
As you know, I've been called an anti-Semite.
Because of a word he used about Israel, so we questioned him. Could you just make briefly the best case you can for why apartheid is the right word to use?
Well, I'll try to make a perfect case.
Our edgy conversation about the Middle East on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Back in 2013, the city of Detroit was billions of dollars in debt. We hear from the man tapped to help find a solution.
Really, the city had no assets other than the Detroit Institute of Art, and all of the creditors wanted to liquidate it.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Donald Trump Jr. is visiting Greenland, the autonomous territory of Denmark that his father, the president-elect, wants to buy. But as Terry Schultz reports, the Danish government is trying to put an end to any speculation that's even possible.
Donald Trump Jr. says this was a private visit and that he wasn't meeting Greenlandic government officials. Greenlanders have not taken kindly to the president-elect's declaration that their country must become part of the U.S. The island is home to a U.S. military base in a location strategically important for missile defense. In any case, Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen says it's not for sale. Greenland is a very, very proud people. It's a language. It's a culture, she told Denmark's TV2. It's a population which is its own. At a press conference, President-elect Trump reiterated that he believed the U.S. needs control of Greenland for economic security. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz.
Last week's deadly truck attack in New Orleans on Bourbon Street will now get a full review from the state's attorney general. Matt Bloom of member station WWNO reports.
Attorney General Liz Merle says her review of last week's attack will look at, quote, patterns and conduct within the New Orleans Police Department and City Hall. Merle says security changes are needed.
I would expect that to happen because we can't ignore what happened and pretend like it didn't happen or that it was just a one-off event.
City leaders have faced criticism for the lack of protective barriers around Bourbon Street on New Year's Eve. Temporary barriers have since been installed. And this week, President Biden granted a request from city officials to provide additional federal resources for Mardi Gras season security. For NPR News, I'm Matt Bloom in New Orleans.
Well, stocks finished lower across the board on Wall Street today. The Dow down 178 points. This is NPR. In China, assisted reproductive services, including IVF, are now covered by insurance. It's part of a broader effort to address the country's declining birth rate. From Beijing, NPR's Awen Tao reports.
The Chinese health authority said in a New Year message that over 1 million people have benefited from the assisted reproductive services last year since it has been covered by insurance. It comes at a time when China's population dropped for a second year in 2023 and hit a record low birth rate with 6.39 births per 1,000 people. But access remains restricted. In China, the assisted reproductive services are only available to married couples. Single women seeking to have children through IVF are still excluded. Alan Tao, NPR News, Beijing.
Here in Southern California, Santa Ana winds are bringing extreme fire danger to areas that haven't seen much rain in months. A massive fire has prompted tens of thousands of people to flee their homes and businesses along hillsides here in Los Angeles today. So far, it's burned more than 1,200 acres in the foothills of Pacific Palisades. Forecasters are warning of life-threatening and potentially destructive wind gusts through Friday. On Wall Street, the Dow lost 178 points, down about 0.4%. The tech-heavy NASDAQ was down almost 2%. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
On a Tuesday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ongoing civil war in Sudan has led to the world's worst humanitarian crisis ever. That's according to the International Rescue Committee. The United Nations says more than 24 million people there are facing acute hunger, and more than 11 million people have been forced to leave their homes because of the war. And today, the Biden administration has declared that the Rapid Support Forces, a paramilitary group aligned against the Sudanese army, has committed genocide. Tom Perriello is the U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan. He joins us now from the State Department. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Tom, I know that you traveled to Sudan in November and you met with the Sudanese army as well as humanitarian groups who were experiencing significant delays in receiving aid for hungry and displaced Sudanese people. Can you tell us what's happening now?
It's a horrific humanitarian situation compounded by these horrific atrocities, including those that were designated today. You're talking about tens of millions of people that have been forced from their home. It was really a famine initially created primarily by the Rapid Support Forces, burning the harvests, burning and looting the warehouses, making it a dangerous and unpermissive environment for workers. Then the SAF side, the army side, about a year ago, started to really create a humanitarian embargo on the country and exacerbate that famine greatly going into the rainy season. Over the last 6 months, with Secretary Blinken's leadership, we've been able to have steady progress in getting millions and millions more access to food and medicine. But the conditions are truly horrific on the ground, not just in terms of food and medicine, but grave acts like shelling of displaced person camps by the Rapid Support Forces. And others.
I'm going to jump in and just ask you this. I wonder what most stays with you from that trip. Is there a conversation or a person that you keep coming back to?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, what you always remember is the stories of Sudanese women, particularly those who've faced rape, sometimes identified specifically for their ethnicity, facing sexual slavery, and really wanting to make sure that those who committed these horrific abuses don't get get impunity, don't get away with it. And I think what you saw with the Biden administration today was that we continue to lead the world in imposing economic sanctions on these bad actors today, including the head of the RSF itself, Hameti, as well as his two brothers previously. And we are going to continue to raise the costs on those that are committing those kinds of atrocities that unfortunately you do hear about and they just do burn into your soul.
I mean, multiple peace and ceasefire agreements have failed since this war broke out. And today, of course, the U.S. government said it's also sanctioning, as you mentioned, the leader of the RSF or Rapid Support Forces. What real impact do you think that this will have to end the war that we're talking about?
Well, you know, it's really been something that Secretary Blinken's been very committed to these talks along with our partners in the region. Unfortunately, we've not been able to get to a national ceasefire. We've had some success with humanitarian corridors, and we're hoping to see the establishment of some humanitarian hubs, maybe even in the coming days or weeks. And we really need to see leadership from the Army side to make that happen. We, you know, support various mediation efforts, including those that we've done with the Saudis before. But ultimately, we have to remember this was a war of choice and a famine created by men. It wasn't a famine that was created by a tsunami or a drought. It was really because these two sides decided first to join forces together to overthrow the civilian transition and then to fight each other at the expense of the people of Sudan.
We mentioned earlier that, you know, peace talks have failed. Even if peace is out of reach right now, there's the hunger that we're talking about. We've got about a minute left. What is being done now to alleviate the widespread hunger that is there in Sudan?
Well, the United States led an effort starting in August called the ALPS Initiative, and it really broke through this enormous humanitarian embargo on 25 million people. And every day we are working with partners to get more trucks through, more flights landed, working with the UN and working with NGOs to get that food in there. The U.S. Has given more than the rest of the world combined, and we need more partners around the world to understand this famine exists and must be addressed. And most of all, we need both sides to allow full access to humanitarian relief. It cannot be used as a weapon of war by either the RSF or the SAF.
We'll have to leave it there. That's Tom Perriello, the U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To Minneapolis now, where officials have agreed to overhaul the city's police training program to address abuses. And this stems from the murder of George Floyd by police nearly 5 years ago. And it is the second time the city has done this. This new federal consent decree follows a state-level settlement that is already in effect. Matt Supik of Minnesota Public Radio is here. Hey, Matt.
Hi there.
So, hi, this all follows an investigation by the Justice Department, which found Minneapolis police used excessive force and engaged in other abuses. What are the key reforms here in this federal consent decree?
The agreement formalizes many policies that the police department put in place when the world's attention was on Minneapolis in 2020. It bans chokeholds and neck restraints and includes limitations on the use of chemical irritants such as pepper spray. The consent decree also requires officers to speak up anytime they see a colleague violating someone's rights, no matter the ranks of those involved. This is already part of the oath that new officers take. Here is Chief Brian O'Hara swearing in a group of recruits last fall.
That you shall intervene in protest, both verbally and physically, if you witness anyone violating another's rights.
There are also restrictions and reporting requirements on the use of force, and another major change mandates that investigations of serious misconduct continue even after an officer quits or retires. At a news conference yesterday, the police chief pledged to exceed the agreement's expectations and earn the community's trust.
Mm. Now, I mentioned the Minneapolis PD was already operating under state court oversight. So this new one, the federal consent decree, what does it add?
There is quite a bit of overlap, but Michelle Gross with Communities United Against Police Brutality says the federal consent decree goes further and, for example, gives the city's civilian oversight board some real power.
If the Office of Police Conduct Review, the panel, finds that discipline is appropriate, the chief actually has to give that discipline. There's no more option to ignore their recommendations.
Now, Gross also notes that the federal agreement prohibits police from assigning off-duty work to higher-ranking officers. That's something that gave Derek Chauvin power over his superiors. Chauvin's the former officer who's in prison for killing George Floyd.
Sure. Now, the Minneapolis City Council have approved this, but we're 2 weeks before President-elect Donald Trump takes office. Any chance he could rescind it?
Well, in his first term, Trump opposed consent decrees, calling them a, quote, war on police. Back in 2017, then Attorney General Jeff Sessions halted negotiations over federal court oversight of the Chicago Police Department, but that agreement hadn't been finalized at the time. The one here is, and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey says only a judge can terminate it, not any future mayor or a future president.
Or a future president. Okay, last question, and it is a timing one. When is this consent decree expected to actually kick into effect?
It'll become legally binding once a federal judge approves it, but there is no set date for that.
All right, that is Matt Supik, reporter with Minnesota Public Radio. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every week, a well-known guest draws a card from the wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. Michelle Buteau says she wasn't sure she belonged in the world of stand-up comedy.
I had, like, coworkers when I first started stand-up tell me, like, you should do stand-up, and I'm like, I should not. Because I would go to shows, and everybody was, like, so unhappy, and I was like, maybe this is not for me. Maybe I'm too happy for this. But I was like, you know what? After sitting through shows, I want someone to feel like they are like also living life. I want to be inspired. And so I'm just like, there's all different types of music and there'd be different types of comedy.
Buteau has found a lot of success. Last year, she starred in the movie Babes, and the TV show based on her memoir, Survival of the Thickest, was renewed for a second season. Her new Netflix comedy special, A Buteauful Mind, at Radio City Music Hall is out now. She talked to Wildcard host Rachel Martin about body image.
One, two, or three?
Okay, I'm going to go for three.
Three.
It's a lucky number.
What's a piece of advice you were smart to ignore?
Oh my God, lose weight. Shut up. People that tell you to lose weight are never a doctor. They never look happy. Like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Lose weight, people won't like you, love you, or you can get a job. Shut up. Not only am I going to keep my weight, I might gain some weight. Okay, I'm going to gain some weight, and I'm going to create jobs, and I'm not going to give you one of them. I'm just going to show you what it looks like to love my body, my double chin, my extra rolls, okay?
Did someone
say... My buckets of thighs! Sauce on the side, you can't afford it. So sorry.
But did someone say the words to you? You will be more successful if you lose weight.
Not only have people said those words to me...
Wow.
Let's say family members at dinner parties. Don't eat that. You're going to get fat and no one's going to marry you. College professor. When I told him I wanted to be an entertainment reporter, he said, you're just simply too fat to be on camera. Casting directors. Quite honestly, culture and society. Because if I don't see myself, then you're saying that something's wrong with me. And that's why diversity matters. It's not just a hashtag. If you see it, you believe you can actually be it. Mm-hmm. Because you're like, oh, there it is. And here I am. But if it's never there, then how do you know that you can even knock on the door to say, I'm here? So that's why it matters.
But like, did you come out that way? Because you're saying even your family told you this. So was there a moment when you made the choice to be like, I'm not going to listen to this, because that's hard.
My wedding, because all my friends are like, you gotta diet. You got to exercise. You got to diet. That's what you do. And I was like, why? And they're like, you just got to do it. And I did it. And I lost a lot of weight. And I was like, this doesn't feel good. And I missed turkey bacon. And my dress was too big and kept falling off of me during my father-daughter dance and all the dancing. And then I literally had like some tequila and a potato and blacked out for the rest of my wedding. And I'm like, why? Had I been pre-gaming, I already found a man that's going to love me no matter what. What am I doing? And that's when I was just like, no.
Michelle Buteau's new Netflix comedy special is A Buteauful Mind at Radio City Music Hall. You can hear more of that conversation with Michelle Buteau on the Wildcard podcast.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com.
This is NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. In 2013, Detroit, Michigan found itself in bankruptcy court. The city was some $18 billion in debt. And the man who was tapped to help find a solution, federal judge Gerald Rosen, says things were really bad.
40% of the streetlights were out. The water and sewer system was completely beyond its shelf life. We were springing floods all over the region. Snow wasn't being plowed. Garbage wasn't being picked up. Police response time was over an hour. There were 12,000 fires a year. And really, the city had no assets other than the Detroit Institute of Art. And all of the creditors wanted to liquidate it.
Meaning sell the art, which would have been a huge blow to one of the most revered museums in the world, as well as the city as a whole. So Rosen figured out a plan to both keep the art and pay off the city's debt. A decade later, now retired from the bench, he has written a full account of his time as the mediator at the center of the complicated deal. The book is called Grand Bargain, the inside story of Detroit's dramatic journey from bankruptcy to rebirth. To get a sense of the scale of the problem Rosen faced, I began by asking how many different entities Detroit owed money to.
Well, there were 170,000 different creditors, but of course, those would be broken into groups. And the major groups were, of course, the retirees. And with their retiree health care debt, which was almost $6 billion, and their pension underfunding debt, which was $3.5 billion, conservatively stated, really it was much more than that. The other creditors were bond issuers and their insurers of all kinds. Of course, it was a bankruptcy, so anything that one creditor got would leave less for other creditors.
Yeah.
In addition, the city workers had had no collective bargaining agreements for years and years, so the unions were an important component of it. These are just some of the groups that we had to contend with. There were many more. Of course, on the political side, there were the Republicans and Democrats in the legislature and the governor, and of course the county executives. Then overlaying all of this was the art, the Detroit Institute of Arts, which was the only asset in the bankruptcy.
So you have people whose, livelihoods are at stake because they were counting on this pension plan as they planned their lives around it and worked for years thinking that it would be there. You have this zero-sum type situation of creditors who want millions and millions of dollars that they're owed. You have the basic services that need to be met. I'm curious how you even begin to get started. Like, how do you decide what the first phone call you're going to make is? How do you sort through all of the different angles of a problem like this at the very beginning?
I began talking to the lawyers for all of the creditors and for the city and for the state, and it was pretty overwhelming. And I began to think of the bankruptcy as bookended, Scott, by, on the one hand, the retirees whose plight was pretty desperate. I mean, these are people who had given their entire working lives to the city, and they were in great danger of having their pensions cut 30 to 35%, which would have been devastating. And on the other hand, the art, which was the city's only asset that could be monetized, and selling the art, selling the museum, liquidating it, seemed to me to be just a terrible idea. You know, Scott, Detroit had been cannibalizing its heritage to mortgage its future for decades. And where had it gotten us? And it just seemed to me that liquidating the art would be the exclamation point on Detroit's obituary.
And just to hop in there, I think a lot of people listening know really well, but for those who don't, we are talking about world-class paintings and murals and sculptures.
In some areas, it had the premier collection of art in the world.
As best as you can in a broadcast interview, because I know we're talking about an agreement that ran probably thousands of pages, incredibly technical, but can you explain the way that you figured out how to check both these boxes at the same time, monetize the art, fund the pensions, keep the art in the museum?
Well, it actually started with a little doodle that I did when I was down in Florida on the cardboard backing of a legal pad. And I'd had this idea that if we could somehow use the art and the pensions to leverage that and raise money, put the art in a trust, and all the money that we raised flow all the money through the trust to the retirees to reduce their pension losses, that could be the beginning of a solution. So I just doodled this idea, which was to have the state kickstart the funding and put the art in a trust, lock it off from all the other creditors, and use the trust to flow any money that we raised over to the retirees. And then I had a bunch of questions, which I wrote down under that. And perhaps quite surprisingly, that little doodle is hanging in the Detroit Institute of Arts now as the core of the solution to the largest municipal bankruptcy in history.
So this deal has now held for 10 years. You have seen a lot of success in Detroit rebounding in a lot of different ways. And I think over the course of that 10 years, the broader political system has gotten a lot trickier and a lot less likely to craft big agreements to deal with big problems. So I'm wondering, you know, especially you're now a full-time mediator, how much of this is replicable to other tricky negotiations or impasses, whether you're talking about municipalities that are facing bankruptcy or just broader big negotiating questions?
It all starts with will, the willingness to find common ground. In Detroit, we had it. We had all these people from all different points on the geographic, political, demographic, cultural compass come together to find common ground and unite around a big idea. If people have the will to find a solution with a little nudging maybe from a mediator, most problems can be resolved. And that's really the story of Detroit.
A lot of this came down in many different points to relationships. You're making a lot of phone calls, you're having a lot of meetings, you're having a lot of breakfasts. You know, that's, I think relationships is one of those things that are kind of frowned upon when it comes to the political culture right now. How important are those? How as important is actually knowing the person you're trying to cut a deal with when you're in a position like this?
Absolutely critical, because it starts with trust. And to trust somebody, you have to get to know that person, talk to them and listen to them. Try to understand what their concerns are. Try to understand what their objectives are, what the issues are that are most important to them. And if you don't do that, I think it's very hard to get the kinds of agreements that we got.
That is Gerald Rosen, a retired U.S. District Court judge and author of the book Grand Bargain, The Inside Story of Detroit's Dramatic Journey from Bankruptcy to Rebirth. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. Guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits, at Progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State. For more than 75 years, AU has supported freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more at au.org/NPR. And from the...
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet. Ain't no hold.
Study their customs, their picturesque ways. In searching for some local color, I ran across a Cuban gent. And he was such a big sensation, I forgot the population. He showed me the city.